Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good Monday afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. Valley weather for the rest of today. We should stay sunny and dry and warm, looking for a high temperature in the lower 90s. And then for tonight, clear skies with lows in the mid-60s. Tomorrow, a lot like today, sunny skies with a high of 90. In fact, Wednesday will be a lot like today as well. And then by Thursday, sunny and breezy and actually warmer with a high of 94. Currently, relative humidity is at 20%, sunny skies and 90 degrees. The Democratic candidates for Arizona Corporation Commission are upset about continued outside involvement in this year's race. KJZZ's Will Stone reports.
Arizona Public Services CEO Don Brandt has created a, quote, culture of corruption, says Democrat and former Commissioner Bill Mundell. That criticism comes after Brandt sent an email to employees saying neither Mundell nor running mate Tom Chabon could be impartial if elected based on their campaign rhetoric. Instead, Brandt encouraged voting for the three Republicans, even Bob Burns, who has led the fight to force APS to disclose whether it was behind dark money spending last election. Recently, the Arizona Association of Realtors began spending on the race in support of the Republicans, leading Mundell to ask,
why would they want to participate in a commission race? The concern is disclosure. Did APS funnel or launder money to the realtors to spend in this race?
APS does not discuss campaign finance questions. The Association of Realtors has not yet commented. The solar industry, typically at odds with APS, has not stayed out of this election either. Solar City recently advised its customers to vote for Mundell, Chabon, and Burns, and it's spent about $750,000 on the race so far in favor of those candidates. Will Stone, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
When the Arizona Republic endorsed a Democratic presidential nominee for the first time in its history last month, it received a lot of attention from political analysts and media outlets across the country. Unfortunately, it also angered a lot of people, and some of them didn't simply send a strongly worded letter to the newspaper's leaders. They issued death threats, threats that were taken seriously. Arizona Republic and Republic Media President Mia Parrish wrote about that in a column on Sunday and joins me to talk about it. Mia, were you surprised by the visceral reaction a number of readers had to the paper's endorsement of Hillary Clinton?
It's a very divisive and divided time. And we expected and anticipated that there would be people who were not happy about it. I mean, that's the nature of a democracy, right? Not everybody agrees, and that's a beautiful thing. The tenor and the volume and the nature of some of those calls were surprising to me.
Unfortunately, people who work in media, and we've talked to newspaper columnists over the years, who get death threats, sometimes on the voicemail, sometimes not, and it's not something people can just brush off. But was there a different tenor to this?
You're right. And journalists are used to getting threats. It isn't something that's especially common, and it's not something that we take lightly, but it is something that occurs when you do the work that we do. And so when these threats came in, and some of them were serious and specific, but we dealt with them. I dealt with them in the way that I typically do, which is to take them seriously, but to calmly take them seriously and to take them to the proper authorities. So we alerted the Phoenix Police, I did, and the FBI and Homeland Security and others about them, because you don't know what could happen, and I wanted to make sure that we were taking proper precautions as well within the building and around our buildings, and that people were being mindful of being careful. But we also historically don't write about ourselves. And so this wasn't something that I was, some of these happened weeks ago. So it wasn't that I wanted especially to write about the death threats that happened against the journalists. But what has continued to roll out over the last couple of weeks is not typical. And having people threaten, they've spit on, they have insulted, harassed, called names, slammed doors at kids going door to door, selling newspaper subscriptions, at people just answering the phones, at people in supermarkets selling subscriptions. They've tried to keep people who are trying to subscribe from doing so. They've menaced them, and that is not normal, and that to me is not acceptable. And then we have received threats as well from from some of those people anonymously through calls and through email saying, you know, if your carriers drive down our roads, we'll get them, we'll keep them from doing that. We'll, I got one today, we're going to pour boiling water. If one of your people comes door to door, I'm going to pour boiling water on him and sick dogs on him.
So how do you proceed as an individual human being yourself, and then how do you proceed mm-hmm. as the leader of a newspaper and an mm-hmm. online site?
I was a journalist before I was a business person, so I'm not unfamiliar with that, with it. So it's not, again, that I take it lightly, but when you're familiar with it and you've experienced it, you are not as freaked out by it, I guess. But I'm also mindful that there are hundreds and hundreds of other people in this building. So for myself, I'm okay. But for the people around us, I'm very conscious of how to make sure that we are being as safe as we can, that we have the security that we can, that we need, and we do have that in place, and that we are contacting the proper authorities around that, and that people who are being directly threatened are being protected, and also keeping people calm about, you know, we don't want to be alarmist, and that's not, that I don't think that's all that helpful either. I don't want to feed that sense of alarm around what we do. I decided to write this, which is, it's unusual. I mean, clearly people don't usually do this, but I think we are in an unusual time.
Do you feel like there is more venom behind them now than there would have been in the past, in part because people have decided that maybe something you print, well, you're lying, or you're not telling all of it? And it seems like that has become, there's more passionate around that as people are able to sort of find their own media and in many ways have the choir, you know, preach to the choir in essence.
There are going to be people who disagree with us. And like I said, that's okay. What we look for is civil discourse. What we look for is an open, healthy debate. We're finding less and less of that. You know, the idea that people would hassle us and harass us and wish us ill and wish us dead and wish for journalism to be gone, which we've also heard, is appalling and frightening to me as someone whose family grew up in a place where there was no free press and where that meant there was no democracy. It's a pretty scary thing.
Mia Parrish is president of the Arizona Republic and Republic Media. And Mia, thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate your time.
As we get closer to Election Day, Get Out the Vote campaigns are ramping up their efforts to remind people how they can vote, where, and important deadlines. This is the first presidential election that Arizona will go through since the U.S. Supreme Court struck down a provision of the Voting Rights Act that in the past was used to combat discrimination in the voting process. Several advocacy groups gathered in Phoenix today to talk about the steps voters can take to make sure their voices are heard, and KJZZ's Carrie Young was there. Carrie, is there any part of the voting process this year that really has the groups worried right now?
Well, you definitely touched on it already, Steve. Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act used to require federal clearance or federal approval of local election laws. That was struck down in 2013, and since then, here in Arizona, there have already been a few laws that have Get Out the Vote advocacy groups a little worried. One of the biggest is our state's new ban on what politicians have called ballot harvesting.
Now, that's where maybe a neighbor can offer to take someone's ballot for them?
It could be a neighbor or really anybody, even someone from an advocacy group taking in quite a few ballots. But if it's not your ballot, or maybe a family member's, then that's essentially illegal here in Arizona now. Samantha Pastras, who's with the Arizona Commission for Election Accountability, says it's not totally clear how this will impact Election Day, but she is concerned that it might be problematic because 65% of voters in Maricopa County, for example, are on the permanent early voting list.
This time, people are not going to have that option. So one concern is all of those thousands of people will show up on Election Day and the counties aren't going to be prepared for them. I think the worst case scenario is that those people don't vote. We want everyone to vote. This is our democracy.
So any particular developments that the groups were excited about?
Actually, yes. They were excited about a new polling location at ASU. Having that on campus, they said, will make it much easier for students to vote on Election Day, especially if they have to fit it between classes.
Now, the Republican presidential nominee has not been shy about using the term rigged, that the election is being rigged. Were people concerned at all about that?
That didn't seem to be a concern at all. Several reporters asked this question, actually. Samantha Pastras, who we heard from earlier, said so many eyes are on these ballots from the time they're submitted to how they're transported and then counted that a rigged election really isn't on their minds. Something else is, though.
We're worried about the long lines, poll workers who give out misinformation. But I think once you vote, I believe that will be counted.
It seemed like the big push really was to early vote or vote by mail so that you do still have time to rectify any issue that might come up before November 8th.
KJZZ's Carrie Young. Carrie, thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
The question of whether Arizona is in play in next month's presidential election has been a disputed one. After all, the only Democratic White House nominee to win the state since 1952 is Bill Clinton. But a strong get-out-the-vote effort in combination with a very non-traditional Republican in Donald Trump has led Democrats to consider the state a toss-up. And this week, some of Hillary Clinton's strongest stand-ins are going to be in Arizona. Tomorrow, it's Bernie Sanders. On Wednesday, Chelsea Clinton will be here. Then on Thursday, it's First Lady Michelle Obama. With me to interpret these visits is political analyst and former state legislative leader Chris Hurstam. Chris, why are these three surrogates coming?
My interpretation is that the Hillary Clinton campaign is finally making its long-rumored move into Arizona big time. What they're hoping to do is steal the Republican state of Arizona and effectively end Donald Trump's chances of becoming president. Donald Trump cannot afford to lose Arizona. That's why he has come to this state six times already. With Chelsea Clinton coming in and Bernie Sanders on Tuesday, and now First Lady Michelle Obama, who's really the top surrogate for Hillary Clinton these days, coming in on Thursday, that sends the message loud and clear that Hillary Clinton thinks she's got a real shot at winning Arizona. I should also point out that just as important is the Clinton campaign's new investment financially into Arizona. They're going to spend $2 million now during the last 3 weeks of this campaign on television advertising, digital advertising, and mail advertising. That is significant.
Based on who is coming to Arizona, as we just discussed, does this indicate to you that the numbers that show this is really a tight one are the ones we should be paying attention to?
Yes. If you look at the Real Clear Politics polling average, which, as you know, aggregates all of the polls that come in and keeps them up to date, as we are speaking right now, Clinton is just 1 point behind Trump in that polling average. So you're going to see some polls with Trump having a few points lead, and you're going to see some with Clinton having a 2 or 3 point lead. It's really a flip of the coin right now. And I should also point out that even if Clinton cannot pull the upset here in Arizona, her push into this state is also an attempt to force Trump to spend time and energy in a state that should be safe for him. So this has ramifications nationally.
So, Chris, who has the biggest impact as far as actually getting voters to turn out for Hillary Clinton in Arizona? Is it Michelle Obama or is it Bernie Sanders?
Oh, I think it's Bernie Sanders on college campuses. That's why he's going to be appearing at NAU and at the U of A on Tuesday. Chelsea Clinton will be at ASU on Wednesday. But the big speaker is Michelle Obama, and she's going to go to where 65% of the voting population is, and that's Maricopa County. Michelle Obama will be in Phoenix on Thursday. And let me just add that I would not be surprised if that's all this week. I would not be surprised if next week or soon thereafter we see the presidential candidate herself, as long as the polling data shows that it's as close as it is today.
Political analyst and former Arizona legislative leader Chris Hurstam. Chris, we always appreciate your time. Thanks.
My pleasure, Steve.
A national report on how cities treat members of the LGBTQ community was released today. It's the Municipal Equality Index put together by the Human Rights Campaign. Three Arizona cities, Phoenix, Tempe, and Tucson, did especially well, while Peoria, Gilbert, and Avondale scored poorly. Xavier Persaud is legislative counsel for the Human Rights Campaign, and he joins me. Xavier, how did the HRC arrive at these scores?
Our scorecard looks at 44 different criteria that ranges a number of broad areas, including non-discrimination protections, city employee benefits, city services, law enforcement, and city official leadership on equality.
Phoenix has 100, and Tucson has 100, and Tempe has 100. Is there a way to harken back to see whether things have changed over the last few years? Have those cities consistently been good at this?
Yeah, we have started this project back in 2012. And the three cities that you pointed out, Phoenix, Tempe, and Tucson, are shining examples of what we've found in this report at large, is that even in states that lack fully inclusive non-discrimination protections, city officials are leading the way in enacting local protections for their LGBTQ communities. And that's what these cities have done. And yes, in places like Phoenix, we've seen this, you know, in the past 4 years, in Phoenix specifically, obtaining a 100-point score despite being in a state without inclusive laws.
So what are some clear examples when a city or a town's rankings get better?
We're looking at specific laws and policies in this report. So, you know, one big chunk of this is whether there are citywide non-discrimination protections in employment, housing, and public accommodations that are specifically inclusive of sexual orientation and gender identity. We're also looking at the city as an employer and the policies that the city maintains toward its own employees, whether the equal employment opportunity policy includes sexual orientation and gender identity, whether the city provides a healthcare plan that is transgender inclusive, and whether the city has a city contractor non-discrimination ordinance that requires that city contractors have inclusive policies for the contractor's own employees as well.
It looks like those numbers are getting much better as time moves on. Why do you think that's the case?
You know, having a I think this project is important because it provides a roadmap for cities to see exactly what they can and should be doing in order to be fully and truly inclusive. You know, and I also think that there's been a greater awareness of the fact that, you know, the majority of states do not have fully inclusive protections, and that it's incumbent on city leaders to extend these protections immediately because, you know, they're incredibly important. I also think that there's been a greater awareness of the economic effects of not being inclusive. Cities that are inclusive send a clear message that they are open for business, that they are welcome, that their residents and visitors are welcome and valued, and that in turn helps cities' economies. So I think a combination of these factors, the report, a greater awareness of the need for consistent protections across the country, as well as a greater awareness of the economic benefits of full inclusivity.
Xavier Persaud is legislative counselor for the Human Rights Campaign. We've been talking about the group's latest Municipal Equality Index. It's the show on 91.5. I'm Steve Goldstein, along with Phil Latzman.
And Steve, the Arizona Diamondbacks are back in the news today after a disappointing 2016 season.
The baseball team is trying to pick up the pieces after missing the playoffs for a fifth straight season and finishing 24 games under 500. They also just barely avoided last place despite high expectations.
And as they begin the process of what went wrong, the Diamondbacks have named Mike Hazen today as executive vice president and general manager. He replaces Dave Stewart, who was fired along with manager Chip Hale a day after the regular season ended. The 40-year-old Hazen comes from Boston. He was there for 11 years. In his final season, he served as the VP and GM of the Red Sox, and he'll now be in charge of the D-backs' baseball operations on a day-to-day basis.
I want to help in any way possible in my role and the role of baseball operations to make this a great franchise. It is a great franchise, but I want to continue to try to take it to another level.
Hazen, who will be the team's fifth GM in the past seven seasons, says his goal is to bring a winning team to Arizona both on and off the field.
We can make commitments to the fans on how we're going to act in the community, on the field, how we're going to play the game. And ultimately, our goal is to win a championship here in Arizona. And that will be at the forefront of everything we do.
And his first responsibility will be finding a field manager to replace Chip Hale. What qualities is Hazen looking for?
I think the ability to connect with players is critical. I think the ability to have an understanding, a true understanding of how hard the game is to play on a daily basis is critical. But number one, we're looking for a leader, and we're going to find that person.
As for whether the franchise needs to tweak their roster or completely rebuild it for 2017, Hazen isn't quite sure yet.
Yeah, we're going to try to compete and contend and put the best team on the field that we can, but in the market that you're in and the challenges that you face, you have to keep an open eye long term all the time. I don't think it's anything that you can ever turn your back on if you're going to make good, strong, sound decisions. But we're committing to winning.
Diamondbacks owner Ken Kendrick was also at this morning's news conference. He says his team had about 10 good candidates for the job, And why did Hazen stick out?
There's a lot of elements to bring together to put a winning, consistently winning baseball operations group in place and keep it going. And as we went through the interviewing process, it was pretty apparent early on, you know, his leadership skills, his presence, his experience, all of those things contributed to him being clearly our choice.
And Steve, obviously Mike Hazen does not have an easy job trying to get the fans back after that awful year, all those expectations we talked about earlier.
Phil, it's a tough market. You came from Miami. If you don't win, it's hard to get people in the seats.
And they're going to have to do that. I mean, the stands were empty last year for a lot of those games, and the issue with the stadium also mixed in. So there's going to be a lot of questions coming into this next season.
So what about the next manager? Any exciting names maybe people have heard of?
I don't know if people have heard of them, but no confirmed names. One stands out from Boston, where Hazen came from. He's said to be very close to Red Sox bench coach Torey Lovullo. So he might be your Diamondbacks' next manager.
KJZZ's Phil Latzman. He always manages to give us a good story. Phil, thanks.
Take me out to the ballgame, Steve. Thank you.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ along with John Hockenberry at The Takeaway. I'm Steve Goldstein. In the 70s, a California businessman with a bit of money and a lot to say started a movement that was laughable at first, but eventually Howard Jarvis became the most powerful man in state politics. Jarvis had two things going for him: a simple idea, and his very identifiable rage.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
That famous line from the 1976 movie Network became Jarvis's campaign slogan for what became Prop 13, Proposition 13, the mother of all state ballot measures, which drastically cut property tax for California homeowners. For the past nearly four decades, it's had a devastating effect on the state's budget and the funding of public schools. Joe Rubin, a producer with our friends at Retro Report, has this look back on how Jarvis gave his anger the force of law.
He kind of seemed like your sensible grandfather, although he was a little bit bombastic and irascible. He had for years been trying to pass a property tax cutting initiative, and he got nowhere. But in 1978, with inflation kind of running away, with people freaked out about the gas crisis and a lot of distrust of government, he had this even more radical idea called Proposition 13, which radically slashed property taxes.
It was viewed as something that was very dangerous and very, very reckless. Here's Howard Jarvis himself.
After all, the basis of a free country is that government must be limited. And now we've got unlimited government. That brings unlimited taxation. That either brings you into bankruptcy or dictatorship.
There was a real problem that Jarvis tapped into, and that was that inflation was very high in the 1970s, and property taxes were going up too high. And everyone knew that they needed to fix it. But rather than, I mean, I think the critics of Prop 13 would say, rather than coming up with a sensible, you know, approach, this was like this tsunami, which, I mean, these changes are in the Constitution of California. That's how initiatives work. And so this is still with us today.
How much did Proposition 13 limit the amount of property taxation?
So right out of the bat, I mean, it cut property taxes 60%. But the magic of Proposition 13 is that it caps property taxes at the point of the last sale. Proposition 13 is kind of like rent control on steroids. Okay, so this house next door, it pays $35,000 a year in property taxes because it's a Silicon Valley house and it sold for $3 million. But the house next to it, which is essentially the same kind of house, only pays like $4,000 in taxes. So you have this very huge disparity. But that's not just with homes, that's with commercial real estate as well. And Jarvis really sold this story that this was about retired people or working people who are going to lose their homes. He had a kind of what some would say an apocryphal story about going to the Los Angeles tax assessor's office with an older woman who was about to lose her home because of property taxes. And he says that she dropped dead of a heart attack right at that moment. Those images stuck with voters, but it has had huge implications in California.
And he showed the power of the ballot measure in California, the statewide ballot measure, and he absolutely positioned himself as the voice of the homeowner and the taxpayer.
We, the taxpayers, have spoken. We have made clear our goals. Now we are watching you.
Why hasn't this been untangled? In other words, the ballot measure's power been reduced.
They call it the third rail of California politics. Do not mess with Proposition 13. So it's been very tough to change it. Now, having said that, people like Antonio Villaraigosa, who's the former mayor of L.A. and the likely candidate for governor in 2018, have said and told us that it's time to revisit Proposition 13 and to have an intelligent conversation about it because we have these huge disparities.
Joe Rubin is a producer with Retro Report, looking back at Proposition 13, the 1970s ballot measure that changed history in California and everywhere else. Thanks so much, Joe.
Fantastic to be here, John.
And that's The Takeaways, John Hockenberry. Mexico is proposing a small change to the rules governing mezcal, not only how it's made or who drinks it, but simply over the word itself. That might sound insignificant, but as KJZZ's Jorge Valencia reports from a recent festival in Mexico City, that tweak could have a big impact on the types of mezcals people drink here in the desert.
Emilio Cervantes is standing behind a booth in a shiny convention center here, sporting a thick mustache and a cowboy hat. He's talking about his favorite subject, his prized mezcal. Sometimes he travels to the States to sell it, but for a conversation here in Mexico City...
I prefer in Spanish.
Okay. And as we're talking, a distributor from down the aisle hands him a sample. Cervantes says it's a mezcal from the state of Mexico, just 4 hours south of Mexico City. It's a fertile region for growing the sweet agave plant that yields tequila's potent cousin, the mezcal. This one is fruity, Cervantes says. A little earthy, herbal. It's pretty good, he says. But the label doesn't say mezcal. It says distilled agave. To figure out the difference, we asked the producer. He says he couldn't afford to go to the convention, so we reach him by phone.
Bueno.
Don Jose Luis?
Jose Luis Medina lives on his agave farm just 4 hours south of Mexico City. He started learning the process of distilling agave plants into mezcal when he was 8 years old.
I really like the work. Mostly, I really like eating the candy from the agave. When you're grinding it, you're also eating. That's how I started learning with my grandfather and my father.
The young Medina helped pluck the wild agave plants. They had to be almost as old as he was, 7 or 8 years old. And even though he's been doing this for more than 30 years now, he claims that it's not his years of experience that make his distilled agave so good.
It's not so much the time, but the dedication and love you put into it. You know that when you do things you like, they turn out the way you want them.
But Medina's farm is outside of the geographical jurisdiction the Mexican government determined 20 years ago was the official origin of mezcal. He can still make and sell his product, but he can't call it mezcal. He has to call it distilled agave.
To me, it's as if they're depriving us of our culture because at the end of the day, the word mezcal doesn't belong to anyone in particular. It's our heritage and our tradition. That word belongs to all Mexicans.
Not exactly. The Mexican government owns the word mezcal, the same way it owns the word tequila, according to the Mezcal Regulatory Council. And a new proposal would force producers outside of the area of origin to call their product aguardiente de agave, or agave firewater. The government says this is a way of thwarting counterfeiters. Small producers say corporations are influencing the government to create these new restrictions and keep out the small producers.
No, that's not the decision. We welcome competition.
Cristóbal Mariscal is the general counsel of one such corporation, the venerable tequila company José Cuervo. Cuervo doesn't produce mezcal, but it's interested in the mezcal market, given how popular it has become in Arizona and elsewhere. Mariscal says he realizes some of the government proposals are tough.
But we don't agree that somebody wants to benefit from the goodwill of mezcal or tequila, for the name of this conversation, if they don't comply with the regulatory standards that we comply with.
Small producers like José Luis Medina have been working with the government. He and others in the state of Mexico expect to get permission to use the word mezcal by early next year. He says with the new label, his distilled agave could sell for twice as much, and his family's quality of life could improve.
Right now, we don't live with a lot of luxuries. We don't eat meat every day. We eat meat when we can.
Medina says that maybe in the future he can afford more luxuries, like actually attending a convention to sell the drink his family has been making for generations. Jorge Valencia, KJZZ News, Mexico City.
And in a check of international news on KJZZ, in Mexico, organized crime has influence even in the smallest communities. But one town fought back, a town determined to save its precious forest from illegal loggers and the cartels that sponsored them. The BBC's Linda Presley reports from Chirán, deep in Michoacán, a state where the Mexican government has been at war with organized crime for more than a decade.
Right here, there were good trees, one of those old trees, you know, big ones, real big. They just cut them and then put them in the truck.
So we're deep now inside the lungs of Chirán, the pine forest. We can see really clearly the spaces here where the illegal loggers, with the help of organized crime, took so much of the timber. So this looks pretty bad here, Ruben.
Yeah, this is one of the most devastating.
So their trucks used to come up this track?
All the way to the top. They say that when they took it full, we're talking about maybe 15,000 pesos, over $1,000.
Chirán depends on its trees. Pine resin for export to China, wood for local consumption. It's a lucrative business, attractive to criminals, and perilous to defend. My husband worked for the authorities managing the forest and trying to stop the illegal logging. He asked the state government and then the federal government for help with security. He never got any reply. Maria Juarez's loss is written all over her face.
In
2011, on February 10th, he went to take some photos of a tree replanting project in the forest. I don't know if they were waiting for him or not, but this was when they chased him and beat him unconscious. He was killed. That's what we heard from an informant. A few weeks after Maria's husband disappeared, and after years of violence and intimidation, the people of Chirán fought back. It was April the 15th, 2011.
That day I was at school when the bells from church were, ringing.
Melissa Fabian's 18. In 2011, her family had only recently arrived back from the U.S. to live in Chirán.
I came back home with my friends, but, everyone in the streets were just running around, and ladies were running around. Yeah, they just, covered their faces, and they were just running around with guns or things like machetes.
Was that scary?
Yeah, it was scary. You could just, hear shooting, people screaming, and the bells of the church just ringing at all times.
Led by women, the people took the law into their own hands. They barricaded the road, stopped the logging trucks, and pulled the drivers out. They burned the trucks and ran the loggers out of town. Then they drove out the police and local politicians who they suspected of collaborating with the cartels. 5 years later, political parties are still banned in Chirán and the town runs its own affairs. Security is maintained by an armed militia and corruption kept at bay with transparency.
We have to give accounts at least once a week to all the town's neighborhood assemblies. So there's no way anyone can pocket any money. But what's important is the involvement of people in the process of government, and everyone participates.
Pedro Chavez is a member of the Consejo Mayor, the town's main governing body. Like most people in this town of 20,000, he's pura pecha. Because of the town's indigenous roots, the Mexican government has given its blessing to Chirán's political autonomy. But Pedro knows the danger hasn't disappeared.
We have a central premise. If organized crime isn't given space, they cannot do anything. If one of us collaborates, that's when the door opens.
Do you worry that the bad guys could come back?
Every part of the community is frightened of that. But I have another fear. We're getting too complacent. 5 years ago, we were at the barricades. We didn't sleep much. So I worry that we're losing that alertness. We think everything's fixed now, but the criminals are reorganizing, getting more aggressive. We must stay aware of the reality facing Mexico.
Pedro Chavez ending that report by the BBC's Linda Presley. The word phoenix seems to have natural poetic roots. How could a city named for a mythological bird that rises from its own ashes not contain that? But up until now, Phoenix has not had its own poet laureate, though Tucson and the state of Arizona have. Gail Brown, executive director of Phoenix's Office of Arts and Culture, is with me to talk about why the city is on the lookout for a poet laureate. Gail, how powerful can words be, especially when put together for a poem, and can having a poet laureate help Phoenicians care even more about them?
I think that's a really interesting thing you bring up about poetry. So poetry is a very, it's a different kind of literary art form. The concision of poetry, someone has said that poetry is the best words in their best order. The idea that every word counts in a poem. And poems, when they're beautifully done, when they're well done, have an opportunity, I think, give us the possibility of seeing the world in different ways. They can kind of help us consider and reconsider who we are, where we are, that kind of thing. So I think that a poet laureate has a great opportunity to bring a love of language to help us be more observant of the world in which we live and reflect those things back to us.
Is that more challenged, do you think, in this day of social media where people are still interested in communication, but they communicate in much different ways?
I think probably the best poet laureate has some ability to communicate with people of all ages. So we are hoping to find someone who's inspirational in that way, who can not only communicate an appreciation of poetry, help us lead us to poetry, but also can cultivate this next generation of readers and writers.
This does seem like the city of Phoenix is experiencing kind of an arts renaissance right now. So it would seem like something like this would fit in perfectly. Is this something that, I mean, is that part of the reason this seems like a good fit, the fact that it does seem like there's momentum in Phoenix for this?
That's exactly right. I would say the arts are flourishing in Phoenix in every way possible, every way imaginable. And the literary arts are also flourishing. We have more and more readings of poetry and other kinds of literature, storytelling. The creative writing program at ASU is extremely productive, not only in terms of their own faculty and the work that's coming out of that department through those individuals, those writers, but also the students that they're bringing out into the world and cultivating as artists. So this is a really good time to capitalize on the strength of the arts in Phoenix and to celebrate this particular art form. Often local arts agencies tend to focus a lot of their efforts, their grant making and their programs on the visual arts and on the performing arts. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the literary arts don't get quite the emphasis that they probably should, and now is a perfect time to change that.
Phoenix is a relatively young city. What does something like this mean about the growth of the city in more ways than one? Mm-hmm.
Well, it's interesting that in the last 5 years, other major cities in terms of population who did not previously have a poet laureate have appointed one. Philadelphia, Los Angeles, Houston, among those cities. And I think that there is probably a time in the growth of a city when they maybe are more reflective about who they are, where they've come, where they want to go. And writers, and maybe poets especially, can help us focus some of that thought and maybe provide some ways of thinking about it in unexpected ways.
Gail Brown is executive director for Phoenix's Office of Arts and Culture. The city will be accepting applications to be the first poet laureate until November 4th. Leaders of the search are hoping to have someone in place in January for a 2-year term. Artist Kehinde Wiley grew up in the 1980s in South Central Los Angeles and was sent to art school by his mom as a 10-year-old. His African-American background blended with his early appreciation of traditional portraits by the likes of Gainsborough, best known for The Blue Boy. That, in turn, has led to his combining classic motifs and colors and patterns with models who are people of color, something Wiley didn't see in museums as a young man. The Phoenix Art Museum is currently presenting a Wiley exhibition called A New Republic, and recently I met Wiley at the museum to talk about his work. I started the conversation by asking what appeals to him about blending the traditional with the contemporary.
I think the appeal for many artists and many viewers is the ability to see something anew. With me, it's always been about a love affair with the classical painting tradition. I've looked at it for years, and I've always wanted to figure out how I can make it live. By insisting that people who happen to look like me occupy that space, the painting tradition has come alive for me and hopefully for the viewer.
Now,
Now, was that a case of looking at the tradition? Were you able to look past it at first and just see the art for what it was? And then as you grew up, you noticed that there were faces that didn't look like you, or was that part of it from the beginning?
Well, my mother put me into art school when I was around 10 and a half, 11. And so for me, there was no choice. Looking at art was in my bloodstream. It was part of my way of being. I think that dismantling the way that art was made came naturally, just because the art classes would have you look at different techniques and different ways of crafting an image. In so doing, you look at it not only for what it says, but how it arrives at your eyeballs. You know, how do you shade something into being? How do you coax to color? All those things are about the act of painting, but I think it came later that I started to really dismantle the what was being said in those works.
Now, one of the more famous portraits of yours is Michael Jackson, but you also are much better known now, certainly, for what we'll call ordinary folks who look like anyone we may see anywhere on the street. Why is that important to find ordinary people, just normal people we'd find anywhere, and where do you find them?
Well, my process is what I call street casting. I walk out into the streets of Brooklyn. I started in Harlem, and I'll go up to people, complete strangers, and ask them to come to my studio and to look at art history books. All the poses are their choice. So they'll go through art history and say, well, this image of this guy on this horse is something appealing to me. And so in a strange sense, it's about my taste, which artists, which books, but it's also about who they choose to be. How it's this relay race of desires between how one wants to be seen, but also how people have been seen historically.
Do you maintain the power to disagree with their choices?
I maintain the power to, at times, create compositions that no one has really thought about. There are paintings that are comprised of various paintings that haven't existed before, and so those are unique compositions.
But do you visualize yourself when you street cast and you see a face or two? Are you thinking to yourself, I want this person to pick that particular portrait because this or this particular background because I think that's where they fit?
Well, the question often to me is, why this person? Why do you choose this person rather than the next? And I think that it's something that you see in the moment. It's something that you see in someone's gait, their sense of self-possession, their sense of grace. And you really want to be able to get that down for history. One of the few things that painting can occupy better than the new media culture is that it occupies time in a very different way. We walk away from decay. We walk away from death. In painting, we will be looking at these images in the full brightness of their youth for hundreds of years. And it's an immense opportunity and an immense responsibility to be able to point to elements of the culture that mean something to you. And I think it's wonderful to be able to point to elements of American society that hopefully hundreds of years from now we'll be able to embrace and recognize in a very strong way as well.
Are you looking to empower some of the models? Are you looking to empower the background from which they come? Do you notice sometimes that some of them, after having been in your portrait, walk a different way, walk with more confidence, or think more highly of themselves?
My work is not a political project. It's not a social project. You know, it's a selfish act of going out into the world and creating these paintings day after day and charting my own set of beliefs or desires, what I want to see in the world. And art has always been about that, well, at least within the last 400 years. Prior to that, art has been at the service of the church and the state. There's always been a sense in which the allegiance of the artist to the commissioner is a tenuous one. Artists have always fought for the freedom to say what it is they want to say. It just so happens that what I want to say corresponds almost directly to a desire for visibility, for a desire of liberation.
How much does or can the art you do reflect the situation? If someone looks at it, are they going to look at some of the young people in your portraits? Maybe not even young people, just anyone in your portraits, and think to themselves, maybe I can understand or look at African Americans in general or any person of color in a different way?
Art is always situational, and it's situational in the way that we read it, the way that we respond to a painting based on what's going on today. But it's also situational in the way that an artist organizes his or her thoughts. I am not immune to the streets of America. I'm not immune to a lot of the state-sponsored violence that's going on in this country. And of course, my aesthetic responds to that, but I don't think that I make the type of work that responds in a very literal way, in a very knee-jerk way to what's going on. I think I'm no stranger to the violence that we're now seeing by virtue of new media, by virtue of the cell phone. I grew up in South Central Los Angeles, where these things were not only acted upon others, but acted upon myself, upon me. I know this from the inside out. And so that desire to have a type of physical and emotional and cognitive freedom has informed my work and its early DNA from the beginning.
Artist Kehinde Wiley. He and I met at the Phoenix Art Museum, which is hosting his exhibition, A New Republic. That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.